The next case on our calendar is 09542, Clayton Adams versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Mr. Mismas.
May it please the court. Chief Justice Moyer, fellow justices, my name is John Mismas, and I represent Clayton Adams, the spouse of the deceased Mary Adams, and Cheryl Boley, who is the executrix of the estate of Mary Adams. There is one issue this court has accepted for review today, and that is Revised Code Section 2307.941A does not apply to take-home exposure asbestos cases against a family member's employer who exposed the employee to asbestos and that family member brought asbestos home on their clothing, causing other family members to become exposed to asbestos and develop an asbestos-related disease. In this case, Mr. Adams worked at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Plant in St. Mary's, Ohio from 1973 to 1983. And during that time period, he was exposed to a plethora of asbestos-containing products. Mr. Adams then brought that asbestos on his clothes, and his wife washed and shook out those clothes, exposing herself to asbestos, which eventually caused her mesothelioma and death. Mrs. Adams was never on the premises of the Goodyear Tire Rubber Facility in St. Mary's, Ohio. This case rests on the interpretation of Revised Code Section 2307.941. I apologize. I should have asked for 3 minutes of rebuttal time, which I forgot to.
Watch your time there.
Okay, thank you. Under Revised Code Section 2307.941, it states, the following apply to all tort actions for asbestos claims brought against a premises owner to recover damages or other relief for exposure to asbestos, and the key word is on the premises owner's property. Without that person being on the premises owner's property, there is no premises liability claim here. Mrs. Adams was never on the property. This section is entitled premises liability. Unless the person is on the premises, according to 2307.941A, this statute does not apply to that. We're not here today to argue whether a negligence cause of action applies, because the only thing that we're here to argue is, does the premises liability claim, is the premises liability statute applicable to Mrs. Adams' claim?
In your view, can the General Assembly modify common law? Can the General Assembly adopt a statute that modifies common law, changes what common law may have been, common law negligence, to statutory law?
I think they do it all the time.
Didn't they do it here?
Actually, I think they did, is because there was a case, I cannot remember the name. It'll come to me, and when it does, I'll repeat it. At the trial court level, in the asbestos court, that Judge Spellacy ruled where a husband worked at a plant where they manufactured paint. And part of that process in manufacturing that paint was that they pour asbestos into it to make the paint, and they use it on the top of barns. Judge Spellacy, in that case, ruled that the wife of that employee came down with mesothelioma, as in this case. And Judge Spellacy ruled in that case that the husband's employer could be liable on a theory of negligence for causing the disease. And I think in one of the major cases that Judge Spellacy relied upon was a case written by a former asbestos judge, Judge Sweeney, who used to sit on this bench, and that case was Musavan versus David. And in Musavan versus David, what happened was is that a woman cheated on her husband, contracted a disease, and then gave that disease then to her husband. And in Musavan, what they said was public health is of utmost importance. And so husband sues cheating man with wife for giving him that disease. And in that case, authored by Justice Sweeney, they actually said that public health is one of the number one duties in Ohio and put liability on him.
And the General Assembly speaks to public health in many ways. I guess I want to read the first paragraph of 94.1. As you know, it's what's been relied on. A premises owner is not liable, that would be Goodyear, is not liable for any injury to any individual resulting from asbestos exposure unless that individual's alleged exposure occurred while the individual was at the premises owner's property. That seems to be a very clear statement to me that the General Assembly says you have to have contracted, whether we agree with it or not, whether the policy should be broader than it is. It seems to me the General Assembly has said this is what the law is with respect to asbestos exposure, didn't it?
Well, I think it says for exposure to asbestos on the premises owner's property. And what I'm saying is that Mrs. Adams was never on the premises owner's property, so how can that law apply? How do you get to one if you can't get through A?
Well, that would mean, if we take your argument, that would mean any time there's a statute that defines the liability of someone, that we could always say, well, the statute doesn't speak to something else because they're in a different situation. But here the statute seems to me it excludes, not expressly, but about as expressly as it can be, it excludes the claim of someone who is the second hand, if you will, has second hand exposure to asbestos. It seems to me the legislature anticipated that this very situation when it adopted this language.
And I guess my response to that, Chief Justice, is that this is a premises liability statute, and we're not talking about premises liability here. We're talking about asbestos traveling from one place to another place. And I guess maybe this would be a good analogy, is that in Buffalo, there's the Durez Chemical Plant where they make phenolic resins. Within about a six-mile area of that, they blew out crocidolite asbestos all over that neighborhood and poisoned tons of people, and there have been tons of cases of mesothelioma cases. Under this statute, those people were never on the premises, and they would never be held liable, even though Durez knew what they were doing. So I don't think that we actually get there. And this statute absolutely leads to absurd results if we take it one step further. Goodyear, until 1969, made asbestos gaskets. After they made those gaskets, they sold them to the public, such as the Navy. So we have a Navy shipment in the South Pacific during World War II using an asbestos-containing gasket from Goodyear. Now, does this come down, when we read this again, does this come down that our sailor was never exposed to asbestos on the premises property, if we read that correctly? I think that's what it says. And let's take it another step further.
Navy owned the ship?
The Navy owns the ship.
The premises owner is not liable. They're a premises owner, are they not?
So is Goodyear, premises.
There are a lot of companies, as we know, that because they have had – this doesn't go just to the manufacturer, obviously. It goes to the statute. I mean, the recovery goes to all sorts of applications of asbestos.
But, Your Honor, if we read the definition of a premises owner under 2307.84T, which is in the definition section, it states – a premises owner means a person who owns, in whole or in part, leases, rents, maintains, or controls privately owned lands, ways or waters, or any buildings and structures on those lands, ways or waters, and all buildings and structures on those lands, ways or waters, and all privately owned and state-owned lands, ways or waters, leased to a private person, firm, or organization, including any buildings and structures on those lands, ways, or waters. That means it applies to everybody. And the problem is that when you read A1, it says a premises owner is not liable for injury to any individual resulting from asbestos exposure unless that individual's alleged exposure occurred while the individual was at the premises owner's property. And if you look at asbestos exposure, it's back to my analogy of the Navy ship. They're a premises owner, and they're not liable. Goodyear's not liable for any asbestos exposure, according to the statute, unless it occurred on their property. So that gasket that they sold as a premises owner under this law says that they're not responsible for that gasket.
But is it not true that we, I think it's true, that many subsequent, many users, applicators of asbestos have been held liable? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is under this statute, that would eliminate that cause of action as well. And it would eliminate, if you took it a step further, of the miner of asbestos selling it to them. So that's a huge, I think it's a huge issue in the case.
Counsel, what did your pleadings say? What was the theory advanced in your pleadings?
We have a standard asbestos complaint that we file in Cuyahoga County, and it goes through everything: negligence, premises liability, products liability, loss of consortium, and wrongful death, and on and on and on.
And you agree that, to the extent you ask for premises liability, the statute would affect that?
It would affect premises liability if Mrs. Adams was on the premises.
So you pled premises liability even though she wasn't on the premises?
Actually, she was on the premises for about 2 or 3 months. She was Rosie the Riveter during World War II. So it was like a 2 or 3 month stint that she was there. But she, even in her own deposition, she claimed no exposure to asbestos while there.
What? So you, if I understand your brief correctly, it's you're saying this is not a case about premises liability.
Absolutely.
Right. All right. So why did you plead premises liability?
Well, a lot of times these cases, the people, when they contract mesothelioma, they die between 6 and 12 months. So when we're filing a case just to cover us and to make sure we have everyone in the case that we need to have in the case, because we don't always have all the facts and all the Social Security records and things of that nature, we file a generalized complaint.
Okay. So I come back to the extent that your pleadings – our premise have some causes of action based on premises liability. That's not what you're here arguing about.
I'm arguing that this statute doesn't apply to her because it's not a premises liability case.
Okay. So let me make it real simple.
Okay.
You would concede that the part of your pleadings, of your complaint that deals with premises liability is inappropriate in this case.
I would agree with that.
All right. That's all I was trying to establish.
Okay.
Your case does not turn on the pleadings that address premises liability. You're conceding that, saying, that's not – the facts don't bear out premises liability in this case.
You're exactly right, Justice Pfeiffer. We're not arguing premises liability because if we just look to some case law, if we look to –
I don't want to belabor that. I just want to establish that the pleadings that you claim allow you to get past summary, and that's what we're technically dealing with.
Absolutely.
Are not premises liability pleadings. It's the rest of the pleadings in your complaint that you say are unaffected by this statute.
Yeah, well, that's true, but I also would like to say that I don't believe the statute applies in this case. So, I mean, if you just look
at... I think that's what unaffected means, but...
Okay. I'm sorry, Justice Pfeiffer.
But you are suing the premises owner. Is that not correct?
Goodyear Tire and Rubber...
Taking liability against the premises owner.
Goodyear Tire and Rubber, yes, is a premises owner.
So doesn't A1 read as a complete bar when you say a premises owner is not liable for any injury to any individual resulting from asbestos exposure unless the alleged exposure occurred while the individual was at the premises owner's property?
But that sort of goes back to my further point of if it didn't occur on the property. A premises owner, as I read the definition of premises owner, it means anybody. And like I said earlier,
If you manufacture a product that has asbestos in it and you sell it, you're a premises owner, and that's your asbestos. So it goes out into the world. Goodyear says, hey, I'm a premises owner. I can't be liable for anything.
Well, and isn't that a matter for the General Assembly to determine whether there should be liability for a traveling product, as you're just talking about it?
It could be, but I think, as I've stated earlier, I don't think you get to one unless you get through A, where it says on the premises owner's property. And here, we don't have anybody that was ever on, well, for that 2 to 3 months as Rosie the Riveter, she was on that property.
No, you do. You have the husband, unfortunately, was exposed to asbestos, and her exposure was derivative of his exposure. Had he not been exposed on the premises, she wouldn't have been exposed.
But
wouldn't that not be a fair reading of
that? That would be fair, but I think my counter to that, Justice Kupp, would be that she wasn't exposed on the premises. She's the plaintiff.
But her exposure derived from exposure on the premises by her husband, and it doesn't. The first paragraph there doesn't talk subsection A doesn't talk like subsection 1 about that individual's exposure. It's a broader exposure, and then you get into A, it talks about the individual who was exposed, and that individual had to be on the premises. But A is broader than that, isn't it?
No, I think it says to all tort actions, and her tort action would be a negligence action. That's her action.
Mr. Mismus, if this is a court of last resort where we're trying to write a rule of law that applies to all litigants and all claimants and all exposures to asbestos and the tragic people who suffer from mesothelioma, you can argue to us that the statute doesn't apply to a take-home exposure case, but what rule of law do you want us to write here? What is the rule that you want us to have that would permit us to let the statute have the meaning that the members of the court are suggesting it has?
I guess my rule of law would be that this case doesn't apply to take-home exposure cases because it's a negligence cause of action and not a premises liability cause of action. A premises liability and general negligence are two different beasts.
You would like us to confine the application of this statute to those who have been exposed on the premises and then have a different application for individuals who received exposure in some other manner.
Yes. And I think that would be a fair reading, and I think that would be fair to the women and children of people that were unknowingly exposed in their household and tragically died from this disease. I've handled a number of these cases, and they are by far the saddest cases you could ever see.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And just as another point to what you were saying about
Your red light's on, so you need to sum up.
Okay, thank you. I would just, as Justice O'Donnell stated, I would like that to be the rule of law. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to argue in front of you today.
Thank you, Mr. Mismus. Mr. Schuster.
Chief Justice Moyer, Justices, my name is Rick Schuster, and I am here on behalf of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Seated at council table with me is Michael Hendershot. In the briefing, it is indicated that the standard of review for this case is a de novo review, and we agree with that. The question before this court is straightforward. What did the General Assembly intend when it enacted Revised Code 2307.941A1? The General Assembly was looking at all tort actions that were being brought against the owners of property in the state of Ohio and around the country. And they were focused on how to deal with these actions being brought against property owners, premises owners in Ohio. One of the causes of action that they were looking at were these take-home exposure cases. They were starting to be seen in Ohio.
Counsel, and you've laid that out nicely in your brief. Referring to Goodyear as a property owner, yes, it was, but it was also an employer and a manufacturer. it seems that the tension in this case is whether or not the General Assembly tried to, by describing as property owner, drop down a veil of protection against lawsuits for this kind of thing over employers and to manufacturers and all of that as well.
The General Assembly in this case, Justice Pfeiffer, was looking specifically at claims against premises owners. And premises owners under A1 are not liable for exposures that do not occur on their property, on their premises. Other parts of the statute address the liability of manufacturers, and there are other statutes that deal with the liability of employers. In fact, I think this court this year has dealt in at least two cases with the employer liability statute. Mrs. Adams here is not an employee, so there is no employer liability issue before this court in this case. Mrs. Adams does not claim that she had any exposure to a Goodyear product, so this case does not involve a claim of Goodyear as a manufacturer of an asbestos-containing product.
So the disease that she died from as a result of asbestos products that were in use in the plant
that
were not manufactured or being manufactured by Goodyear.
That is correct. In fact, the complaint named many, many manufacturers of the asbestos-containing products that were located in the Goodyear plant. Goodyear was not named as a manufacturer of asbestos-containing products in this case.
So in trying to determine what were they trying to do here, the General Assembly was attempting to take employers whose employees became exposed to asbestos products in the course of their work in their plant to protect them if someone like this woman had an asbestos injury. Her recourse was going to have to be against the manufacturers of the asbestos products and not against the manufacturer or the employer where the asbestos became friable and went out on clothing.
That is correct in part, Your Honor. The legislature went beyond that in that they were protecting all owners of property. For example, your home up in the Bucyrus area may have been built prior to 1972. And if it contained asbestos, you potentially could be liable as a premises owner if someone came over to your house for dinner and inhaled some friable asbestos. The legislature was keenly aware of the housing stock and the building stock in the state of Ohio and how much of it was built prior to 1972. And so it dealt with these issues.
Is there something in the legislative history of this statute that would give us an indication that the General Assembly was considering this secondhand exposure when they drafted this statute?
The uncodified section of the statute has a number of findings, and it talks about a number of different actions. I think the key, though, is the term all tort actions. The General Assembly was very clear in this section to say that they're dealing with all tort actions being brought against a premises owner. It's not a premises liability section. This part of the statute never uses the term premises liability. It talks about tort actions being brought against premises owners. They were looking at property owners and what are the claims being made against property owners, and they set out several different sections here. We're dealing with one of them.
And so in response to the position that Mr. Mismus offers, that this being a negligence case and should be accepted from the ambit of the statute, you think the language used by the General Assembly is all-encompassing, regardless of how he characterizes the pleading.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be my position. I believe that the General Assembly's intent was very clear, and it was looking at all tort actions. Tort actions is defined in the statute. You can find that in one of the later sections, or in section 2703.91II. They define that. They also define asbestos claims in 2307.91C. They are both broad definitions. The General Assembly wanted to encompass all types of causes of action in the statute. It was a comprehensive reform effort with respect to the asbestos litigation that had proliferated in Ohio. We had over 44,000 cases at the time this statute became effective on September 2nd, 2004.
We still have 44,000, don't we?
No. The judges of the courts in this state have administratively dismissed, I believe, over 35,000 cases, and we probably have around 8,000 cases left pending.
Those are the active cases, but those others are they're only administratively dismissed, and they can be reactivated at any point.
They can be reactivated under the terms of the statute if they find these people actually have an asbestos-related injury.
Mr. Schuster, in your brief, you credit the General Assembly with practically being clairvoyant. You said that they knew this take-home injury was mushrooming as another source of litigation, and they did this in anticipation of something that was just beginning to burgeoning up, and in anticipation of several state Supreme Courts later deciding that this was the way to go.
Your Honor, I would not consider the General Assembly clairvoyant. However, the General Assembly was presented with testimony in both the House and the Senate about these take-home exposure cases that were beginning to show up in Ohio and a number of other states.
In this case, there doesn't appear to be any question about the injury and the tragic demise of this lady as a result of the injury. And you also said this is a de novo at this point in this court. Is that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So what I want to explore then is the proximate cause of her injury. What would that be?
Well, Your Honor, the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company won on summary judgment before that issue came before the court for final determination. But for purposes of the motion for summary judgment, I think everyone assumed that Mrs. Adams' mesothelioma resulted from exposure to asbestos.
Which became friable in Goodyear's plant.
Perhaps not only in Goodyear's plant, but some of it would have become friable in Goodyear's plant for purposes of the motion for summary judgment.
So if you're doing – these are tort cases. So if you're doing tort cases, you've got to show proximate cause, and the proximate cause goes back to the friability of somebody's asbestos that they produced and sold to Goodyear and was installed in the plant in machinery or in pipes or wherever it was. Became friable in their plant. So the friability, which then allowed it to filter into his clothes, would be the proximate cause, wouldn't it?
Well, the friability of the asbestos meant that the asbestos fibers could become airborne, become attached to his clothes,
and
actually the proximate...
That might be the fault of the manufacturer, or it might be the fault of Goodyear for something they were doing in the plant that loosened this stuff up and became friable. So what the General Assembly said is, you don't have any duty, isn't that...
That is correct, Your Honor. That's exactly what the General Assembly said here.
And that leads me then, if this is de novo... How can they do that and not violate the right to remedy clause?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there were numerous defendants in this case, and the General Assembly was only dealing with a premises owner defendant who was being sued. There were many other causes of action that preceded, and I believe they actually
but
came up
to
trial.
But if the proximate cause could have been Goodyear's activities in the plant, and if all the manufacturers come in and say, hey, our stuff was manufactured in a fashion that it should have never become friable, and but for something Goodyear did, it wouldn't have been, then this statute would foreclose her only remedy.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that's correct. And number two, and most important, there is no constitutional issue before this Court. First of all, in the jurisdictional brief, that issue was not raised, and this Court did not accept that issue. So under your rules, you will not decide it. Secondly, it wasn't raised in the Eighth District Court of Appeals. So it's waived on two occasions here. So I don't believe that issue is before the Court, and I respectfully disagree that there would be a violation of the Right to Remedy Clause anyways. You've decided recent cases here. The General Motors case dealt with that issue, and I think if that issue was before you, that would be dispositive. However, it's not before you. The appellant waived that issue twice, once before the Court of Appeals, and secondly, when it filed its jurisdictional brief.
What is the status of the cases, the actions against the manufacturers? Are those still pending?
It is my understanding that those cases have now all been resolved, Your Honor. But we were not participating in the case, so I can't tell you the exact resolution. You'd have to ask my colleague.
Okay. Is there anything for us to write beyond what the Court of Appeals has done if the Court agrees with your position in this case, Mr. Schuster? Or is there some avenue that you want us to pursue or something we could articulate for
If I understand your question, Your Honor, is there any course of action for the estate here?
No. My question is, if this Court agrees with the position you're advocating, that is that this statute encompasses all tort claims, what rule of law do you want us to write, or what is it beyond what the Court of Appeals has already written in their opinion that we should write?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals wrote correctly what the rule of law was. I think the rule here is that the courts of Ohio will look to the intent of the General Assembly when reading a statute. And if the statute is clear on its face, the courts will apply that statute.
We've said that literally thousands of times.
I agree, and it can be said again here and with specificity with this statute, that the statute clearly says that a premises owner is not liable for asbestos exposures that occur off-site, that do not occur on the premises. If there are no other questions, I believe I have used up all my time. I would ask this Court to affirm the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals. Thank you,
Mr. Schuster. Mr. Missmas, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I just would like to say a few words at the end here. We talked about the intent of the General Assembly, and there's two parts of the intent of the General Assembly under Section 3. It says, one, give priority to those asbestos claimants who can demonstrate actual physical harm or illness caused by exposure to asbestos. That's Mrs. Adams. Four, it states, conserve the scarce resources of the defendants to allow compensation of cancer victims and others who are physically impaired by exposure to asbestos while securing the right to similar compensation for those who may suffer physical impairment in the future. That's Mrs. Adams.
What are the status of the cases against the other parties?
They've resolved themselves.
Have they been settled?
Yes, they have.
None of them went to litigation?
We started trial for four days against Mahoning Valley Supply after we filed the case and went through everything. We started trial against Mahoning Valley Supply, and I think one of the other important things here to look at is under the Apportionment of Liability Act, Goodyear has a complete immunity, but they go on the verdict form as a possible party that gets assigned a share of the liability. So as Justice Pfeiffer was saying, it shuts the door. There's no duty, but on the other end, we have them stuck on the verdict form. So where does that leave Mrs. Adams in the end when we do try the case? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Missmas. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Counsel, you're excused. We have an admission ceremony. The next matter is on our calendar is the admission on motion of attorneys to the Bar of Ohio. Our procedure is as follows. I'll call on the presenter to please come forward, and you can tell us briefly why you think the applicant you're representing would make an excellent member of the Bar of Ohio. I'd ask that the applicants, as you're being introduced, please stand in place at the end of the presentations. I'll ask the applicants to come forward, and Justice Lindbergh Stratton will administer the oath of office. If you like, the presenters, if you want to identify your area of practice, we'd be happy to know that, or the firm with which you practice, or whatever. The first presenter is John Smith.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Smith, believe it or not. I practice in Warren County, Ohio, Springboro specifically, and I reside in Cincinnati. I've been involved in the practice of law here in this state since 1980. I have a general practice. It's a general litigation firm, criminal and civil. I'm proud and privileged to present for admission to you Joseph D'Amato of Cincinnati, Ohio. I have known Mr. D'Amato and his family for many years personally. They enjoy a very strong and good reputation in the Cincinnati area. I followed Joe through law school at the University of Dayton, and then when he transferred to Loyola of Chicago. I kept in touch with him while he practiced law in Chicago for 5 years in a defense firm doing mainly workers' comp defense. He clerked for me when he was in law school. I always knew he was capable of doing a good job, and so I am fortunate that he has accepted my invitation to return to practice with me in Warren County. He is of the utmost integrity and competence, and I am quite certain, as he has worked for me more as a clerk for the last year, that he will be a credit to the Bar of Ohio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Brian Elliott.
Morning, Chief Justice Moyer, Justices. My name is Brian Elliott. I've been an attorney in Ohio since 1995. I practice here in Franklin County. I am a sole practitioner. I'm here today on behalf of Heather DeMacy. I've known Heather for over 14 years. My wife and I have been friends with the DeMacy family since law school. Heather had a practice in Pennsylvania prior to moving to Ohio approximately 5 years ago. Her practice was very similar to mine, sole practitioner. We've talked a lot over the years about our law careers and the legal practice. I am confident that Heather is an intelligent, reasonable, knowledgeable, and hardworking individual. She's a good advocate for her clients. She's not only a good attorney, she is also a good person. She believes in concepts of honesty and integrity. She's loyal. She's dedicated to her family, and she sets a good example for her children. It's my belief that she will enhance the bar to Ohio and move to this court to admit her to Ohio.
Thank you. Patrick Booth.
Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, good morning or afternoon or whatever it is right now. My name is Patrick Booth, and with consent of this court and approval, I'd like to submit William J. Donovan for admission to the Bar of the State of Ohio. Like many of the other presenters here this morning, I too am proud to have the opportunity to present Mr. Donovan, just as they are with the people they are presenting. What is unique in this situation is that Mr. Donovan also happens to be my my mentor at the law firm at which I work, and has been my mentor since the time that I was licensed to practice in both Pennsylvania and Ohio. Mr. Donovan has practiced law for approximately 14, 15 years. He's currently licensed in the state of West Virginia and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Both of us are litigation attorneys at the law firm of Burns, White & Hickton, with offices in Pittsburgh and Cleveland, as well as other areas. Due to what I know personally and professionally about Mr. Donovan, and with the high esteem and regard in which I hold him, there is no one I am happier to be able to stand here before all of you and present today. Thank you.
Thank you. James Reeves.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is James L. Reeves. I've been licensed to practice law in Ohio since 1978. I'm currently chief litigation counsel for American Electric Power Service Corporation. I'm privileged this morning to present to you Abby Felrath, a co-worker at American Electric Power. Abby received 2 degrees from the University of Notre Dame, getting both her undergraduate degree and her law degree. We affectionately refer to her as our double domer in the department. She graduated approximately 12 years ago, went into private practice in Indiana for a couple of years, and then joined the American Electric Power System in-house at our Indiana office approximately 9 years ago when I got to know her. Since then, she has relocated to Columbus and practices with me in our litigation section just up the street here. I've known Abby now for 9 years. I know her to be of the highest ethical and moral character and a great practicing lawyer, and without reservation recommend her for admission to the Ohio Bar.
Thank you. Lisa Michaels.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lisa Michaels. I am an attorney with the law firm of Mann Bracken in Cleveland, Ohio. I have been practicing in Ohio since 1996 in the area of creditors' rights and contract litigation. It is an honor and a privilege to stand here before you this morning and recommend Kelly McBeth be admitted into the practice of law in the state of Ohio. Ms. McBeth is a native of Cleveland, Ohio, and currently works in our Washington, D.C. office. I have had the privilege of working with Kelly closely on a daily basis on numerous litigation issues, and every day she demonstrates her competency as a lawyer, her dedication to her clients, as well as to the legal profession. I believe that Ms. McBeth is an excellent addition to the Ohio Bar, and it is with great pride and pleasure that I ask that she be admitted into the state of Ohio. Thank you, Your Honors. Happy holidays.
Todd Stockwell.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Todd Stockwell at Stockwell & Smedley from Lexington, Kentucky. We also have an office in Dayton, Ohio. This morning I'd like to present Christopher Smedley for membership in this bar. I've been a member of the Ohio Bar since 2004. Mr. Smedley has worked with me and first worked for me and then with me since 2001. I've known him to do outstanding work and I believe he'd be a great member for this bar.
Thank you. Amelia Bauer.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. It is with great pleasure as the managing partner of the Columbus, Ohio office of Plunkett Cooney that I ask you to present for admission to the Bar of the State of Ohio Patrick J. Winters, who is an outstanding associate in our Bloomfield Hills Michigan office, yes, I said Michigan, and works in the area of insurance coverage. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a motion that the applicants be admitted to the Bar of Ohio?
Move the admission of the applicants.
Hearing no objection, the applicants will please come forward and follow the directions of the marshals, and you won't get in any trouble. The oath will be administered by Justice Lundberg Stratton.
You may use the word swear or affirm. If you raise your right hand, state your name.
I, Patrick Winters.
Hereby swear. That I will support the Constitution.
That I will support the Constitution.
And the laws of the United States.
And the laws of the United States.
And the Constitution.
And the Constitution.
And the laws of Ohio.
And the laws of Ohio.
And I will abide by the rules of professional conduct.
By the rules of professional conduct.
In my capacity as an attorney. An officer of the court. I will conduct myself. With dignity and civility. And show respect towards judges. Court staff and clients. Fellow professionals. And all other persons. I will honestly. Faithfully and competently. Discharge the duties.
Discharge the duties.
Of an attorney at law.
I'm an attorney at law.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
On behalf of the court and the Bar of Ohio, I welcome you to our bar. We have a very strong bar in Ohio. We're proud of our bar, and we hope it's at least as strong now as it was before you became members. Congratulations. Good luck. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye.